A, an angry black man, B, a scary black man, C, an angry, scary black man, or D, killed your mama?
Egocentric, angry, scary, yeah.
Well, we've done it to another hour, gentlemen. I don't know how we manage it, but we have.
Uh-oh.
And now, Peter, you can go back to quietly playing Nation States. And if you'll send everybody, a telegram, we'll all be your nation friend.
I am so going to do it. I'm going to have to find. I'm hoping that at ELO or Gene or somebody will send me a link to everybody's site, and I'm going to figure out how to telegram everybody.
Okay.
And do I join you? How does it work? Is it like an amoeba? We all become, or do we have to join one or the other? You have to choose.
Well, you'll join Tierra del Horn.
Okay.
Yeah, and
then we're all in there. Okay.
Yeah, we are Borg.
Okay, cool. I'm all for it.
All right. Peter, we'll talk soon. Thanks a million. John, you're on the way. It's Billy Shear's music
Billy
night.
Shear's coming.
All right, great. See you on the other side. In the meantime, here's Lowell George, the late great, reminding you to...
top to what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see, the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, 11,
and most of
11, and
amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up, all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show, right here on the Horn. It's Foxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Foxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4 head on. That's 877-443-2366, or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-658-5453. Yeah. Your host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
Hey, hey, everybody. Welcome aboard Foxed Up for a Thursday night or Friday morning or Friday afternoon, all depending on where you might reside on this beautiful blue marble, such that it is. And being that it's Thursday night, you know that that means it's Billy Shear's music night. And we'll get there in just a moment. And we got a good one. We got a really good one tonight. Mr. Jack Johnson. I kind of dig what this guy does. Even though I unfortunately went on a little bit of a bag fest of the subject from last week, but I sometimes just cannot hold my personal opinions back. But Jack Johnson, I kind of dig this guy. And, you know, was a professional surfer. His dad is a really, really, really famous surfer, Mr. Jeff Johnson. But we're going to get there in a minute. Got a couple of other things that we're going to talk about. One of the things we're going to talk about a little bit later, I just found out about this before going into the horn section with Bob and Peter. Lilo in the chat room sent me a website for a place called ediblecommunities.com. And this looks really interesting, you know, because I talk about reconnecting with food, you know, that people need to reconnect with where our food comes from and, you know, how it's produced and that kind of thing. And I'm getting the impression that this organization is all about that. So we'll talk about that in a little bit. And Bob sent me something that, you know, just about made me choke on my coffee this morning. Right-wing activists are paying school children to debunk global warming. And we'll get to that. I just about went running around the room screaming when I saw this little post that he sent me. Thank you, Bob. You know how to you know how to start my day off on a high note. the lunacy that goes on in this world to keep us from actually doing anything about anything just drives me absolutely insane. So we're going to get into, though, Mr. Billy Shears' music. Don't forget, every Saturday night here on the Head On Radio Network, Billy Shears presents Night Sounds from 9 to midnight Eastern Standard Time. Or actually, you're in daylight time now, aren't you? Whatever. But 9 p.m., whatever your clocks are at the moment. And you can find him at BillyShearsMusic.com. So without further ado, Mr. Billy Shears and Jack Johnson. Roll it, Bob.
This is the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Jack Johnson is a Hawaiian-born singer-songwriter, musician, filmmaker, and surfer. His music is best described as acoustic soft rock. Here, Jack Johnson talks about his passion for surfing.
Surf usually more than I play music when I'm home. It's hard to get me to rehearse or anything. It's like mostly just always surfing if I get a chance. I think I got my first board when I was probably five. And growing up in Hawaii, it's kind of, you know, people start surfing. Well, usually like I know I see my brother now, he does it with his kid. It's like you take them out before they can even really swim. You know, you take them on the surfboard when they're little babies. And it's just once you become a surfer, you realize how much love it brings in your life and everything, and it's just like the first thing you want to teach your kid to do, you know. I think so my dad was always taking me out and dragging me in the water before I can remember.
Mm-hmm.
Johnson was brought up with influences such as Nick Drake, Cat Stevens, Ben Harper, The Beatles, Jimmy Buffett, Bob Marley, and Neil Young. But perhaps his biggest influence comes from an unexpected artist, Jimi Hendrix.
Everything ahead of us we left, everything behind. But nothing that we needed at least, not at this time. And now the feeling that I'm feeling well, it's feeling like my life is finally mine. And with nothing to go back to, we just continue to drive. And without you I was broken, but I'd rather be broke down with you by my side. So without you I was broken, but I'd rather be broke down with you by my side.
Yeah, I love Jimmy. Just like probably a lot of guitar players do, but I never was that fancy with guitar, like as far as learning how to do, you know, guitar solos and stuff like that, but I just always really liked his songwriting. I thought he was just a really kind of far-out, freaky guy when I was a kid. I heard Wild Thing, like him cover that song Wild Thing, when I was really young. And I used to really be into that. Like, the same time I was into, you know, Kiss, because I liked the way they looked and stuff. When I was a little kid, I had the record. And Devo, because they wear, like, pots on their, you know, like a potted plant on their head and stuff. And I thought they were all silly. And Jimi Hendrix would sound kind of crazy. Like, he would do, I'd hear a version of Wild Thing, and it was like, he'd play the song for a couple minutes, and then he would just start making noise. And I'd never seen what Jimi Hendrix looked like. I just had this tape that my brother made for me, and it had Wild Thing on it. And then I remember he just freaked out for like 10 minutes. They just made noise, you know, and I was just thinking, like, well, who is this guy? He can't be an adult. He seems like a kid. He's just making all this noise and stuff. And that was what kind of got me into Jimi Hendrix at first, was Wild Thing, believe it or not. But then I remember I got like a job doing working at this pizza place called D'Amico's in Hawaii. And then when I first had my own tip money, I went out, like the first record I went out and bought, I'd probably gotten gifts before for Christmas and stuff of just different bands, but it was like right when I started getting into music myself and thinking, okay, I want to go use my money and buy a record. And I went in the store and I was going to buy it. Somebody told me to get Jimi Hendrix, you know, his first record, Are You Experienced? And then they didn't have it, so I got Electric Ladyland was the first one I got. And it just had these crazy songs, you know, I just started listening to that all the time and just really got into it. I just like the songwriting a lot, you know. I like his freaky guitar playing too, but I guess what I get out of it is the songwriting, you know. He just seems like a really beautiful songwriter.
Jack Johnson talks about his song, Fortunate Fool.
I wrote that in Maui when we were camping one time. My wife and I, we went hiking on the Nepali coast. I remember writing that song because I was like strumming it in this little tent. I remember kind of writing most of it one night. I think with Fortunate Fool, that was actually from, what play was it where they say, life is but a walking shadow, a poor player who struts and frets his last moment upon the stage and then is heard no more. It's a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury but signifying nothing. It's a bunch of fortunate fools. It might be two different things, but it's something about it. It's like a Macbeth or something, I forget.
But she's the one that stumbles when she talks about the seven foreign films that she's chucked out. Such a fortunate fool.
Now here's Jack Johnson with one of his most popular tunes, Sitting, Wishing, Waiting.
sit and wait and wish you believed in superstitions, then maybe you'd see the signs. Lord knows that this world is cruel, and I ain't the Lord, no, I'm just a fool, and I'm loving somebody, don't make them love you. Must I always be waiting, waiting on you? Must I always be playing, playing your fool? I sang your songs, I danced your dance, I gave your friends all a chance. Putting up with them wasn't worth ever having you. Or maybe you've been through this before, but it's my first time, so please ignore the next few lines, cause they're directed at you. I can't always
thank you, Billy Shears. Yeah, I dig what Jack does, you know. It's on the mellow side, but he's a fine player, you know. Writes a good lyric. And, you know, it seemed, I think, again, you know, the more important than anything is it comes across as being pretty damn honest, you know. It's he writes who and what he is. It's good stuff. Thanks very much, Mr. Billy Shears. And I believe you can find out more information by going to jackjohnson.com. And there's also quite a decent Wikipedia page on him talking about the, you know, his father and actually the reason that he left surfing was during the pipeline trials one year. He took a really bad spill on a surfboard and, like, knocked out all of his front teeth or something. So he decided that, hey, you know, playing guitar might be a little less dangerous. So thanks again, Billy. Check out Billy Shears Saturday night here, 9 to midnight, on the Head On Radio Network with Night Sounds. And also check out the website, BillyShearsMusic.com. Now, I've been sitting here while listening to that segment going, do I do the thing that's going to piss me off first or save it for later? I think I'm going to get out of the way and then get on to more positive things afterwards. Bob sent me this thing from Think Progress. Get this. Right-wing organization paying kids for denying global warming. The right-wing organization WorldNet Daily is rewarding children for debunking global warming in a new video essay contest. The contest was launched in early 2008 and was designed to highlight the absurdities, untruths, and downright lies that children are being taught daily about climate change in public school. The site states, contest winners will receive a cash prize, a copy of The Great Global Warming Swindle DVD, courtesy of junkscience.com, boy, does that domain name apply really well to that documentary, Junk Science, because it is junk science. The irony is not lost on me. And also, they'll get copies of The Sky's Not Falling for their local school library and their kids' science classroom. And there's a video where you can watch one of the submissions. Kids across America are being victimized by global warming hysteria, according to Holly Fretwell. Fretwell? Author of The Sky Is Not Falling, Why It's Okay to Chill About Global Warming. Okay, this, like, makes my head cave in for how many reasons? And I actually, the very first comment at Think Progress, I think, states it very, very well. It says, well, gee, what's wrong with that? After all, everybody knows that cigarette smoking has nothing at all to do with lung cancer. Snark off. Now, I unfortunately did have to go over to WorldNet Daily, WND.com. And the post is Al Gore's global warming debunked by kids. Are we trying to belittle a really good guy here? Nah, not at all. And they say here, and you got to, you know, WorldNet Daily, you got to remember that this is a serious, serious right-wing site. Al Gore's global warming philosophy has been debunked by many scientists and studies. Oh, is that so? And now it has met the same fate at the hands of children in the Sky's Not Falling video essay contest sponsored by WND Books, formerly World Ahead Media. Boy, that's an opposite world name. How about A Century Behind Media? The contest was launched in early 2008, was designed to highlight the absurdities, blah, 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 I read this before. Russell Young, a Minnesota writer who captured first place in the essay competition, explained the importance of using celebrities as such as Gore and the medium of movies to enhance the educational experience for students. Here are just a few other films schools might use for their teaching curriculum. The Polar Express could be used for instruction on transportation systems. Borat is a perfect teaching tool for understanding how the Democratic Party uses focus groups. Alien could be used to teach students about anatomy and homeland security, all at the same time, he wrote. Pardon me? Far-fetched, you say? Maybe not. Moby Dick taught me all I ever needed to know about whales, and I'm a marine biologist, he said. Oh, right. Kids across America are being victimized by global warming hysteria, according to Holly Fretwell. Fretwell, that just kills me. That's got to be a made-up name. Fretwell. Hi, Fretwell. Oh. I wanted to know what kids just like mine are hearing in their classrooms, Fretwell said. Running a contest was a fun way to go about it. All of us, and our children in particular, are being confronted daily with half-truths and falsehoods about global warming. It's just plain wrong, she says. Right, okay. I want kids to get excited about science and to understand that it's human ingenuity and a can-do spirit, not government sanctions, that will lead us to a bright environmental future. I want kids to learn how to become critical thinkers, she said. Oh, really? Contest winners will receive a cash prize, a copy of the Great Global Warming Swindle DVD, and a copy of her book, funny that. And over at the page, there's a couple of videos. I watched one, but there was no actual audio to go with it for me to grab. Now, they say the first place essay is titled Al Gore Causes Global Warming in School-Aged Brains by Russell Young of Minnesota. If Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth, is suitable for teaching about climatology, then Alfred Hitchcock's film, The Birds, is a good candidate for teaching ornithology. What? What? Wait a moment, you say. What does a horror film, which has been characterized as extremely disturbing, where hordes of normally skittish but peaceable birds inexplicably attack and terrorize humans, have to teach our children about science? The answer is, of course, that it could be used to anesthetize them to the frightening scenarios presented in Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. What a bunch of just absolute dribble is all of this. And the fact that, you know, the scientists disagree. Yeah, barely any of them. I reiterate, when it comes to the consensus on climate change, it's 99 to 1. How many times do I have to say this? 99 to 1. But yet these assholes want to make it as though the 1 is equal to the 99. Sorry, my math doesn't work that way. I like, you know, real math and real science. And, you know, I watched this one video clip, and it's all this text going through, talking about how 2007 was, you know, supposed to be the hottest year on record, but was only the sixth hottest. And all that kind of nonsense. And it's this cherry-picking of the science, as opposed to looking at the holistic nature of the planetary environment. And, you know, you notice all the little bits here about, you know, not needing government sanctions. You know, it's all this, it's all this business first thing. You know, old business first thing. To offer a cash prize for something as devious as this. I mean, is this not training to be a good Republican early? Don't worry about the facts, kid. Just stick to the message. Wrap your facts, cherry pick your facts to fit your message. But we're going to give you the message now, aren't we? I mean, you know, yeah, there may have been a couple of minor inaccuracies in Al Gore's film, but those were based on the models that he had at the time. And very clearly in the film, he is describing the worst case scenario. That's made fairly clear. But since that film's been made, we've seen every time they make a model, it ends up showing that it's accelerating. Now, we're going to have a whole bunch of people going, you know, boo this year because we are in a La Nina cycle. Okay? Y'all know about the El Nino, La Nina thing. We are at the moment in the first La Nina that we have had in 7 years. Now, just being observational, you know, looking around where I live. Since I moved to Australia, we've had 7 years of extraordinary extreme drought. Many parts of this country are still in drought. However, we have had unbelievable rains this year. Absolutely off-the-scale rains. But this is the thing that one has to remember. Previous to 30, 40, 50 years ago, if you looked at a decade, pretty much you ended up with half the years being El Nino, half the years being La Nina. And you kind of end up having a bit of a balancing out. Well, over the last few decades, it's become more and more El Nino, the hot one, the really, really hot one, where this country here, Australia, goes bone dry. So if we end up with a year or two of rain, it's not going to make up for the 7 years of drought. It's just not going to work. And when the El Nino pattern kicks back in, we're going to have a whole bunch of fresh growth ready to burn in bushfires. And I mean, it has been a really wonderful respite for the emergency services in this country, that this year they actually had a fairly mild bushfire season, when over the last few years it's been absolute chaos. So at the moment, there's this little window for the deniers and the liars to come out and say, oh, but it was cooler this year. It's like, hello, fluctuation. You have to look at the bigger picture, which these people can't. These people have no way, you know, they in no way look at the bigger pictures. And as Bob says to me here in the in our production chat, says, ask the Maya from 1,200 years ago about hoping two good years will make up for seven bad ones. And last night was a really wonderful, and I think you can even watch this online. If you go to abc.net.au and look for a program called Catalyst. It's the weekly science magazine from the Australian ABC. And they did a piece, they did the entire half hour last night on the health of the Murray-Darling River system, which is the main river system in this country. It starts all the way up in northern Queensland, goes through New South Wales, through Victoria, and pops out at Adelaide. Now, because of the weirs and the dams and things that have been put in, and the extreme drought, they actually showed last night, you know, we've had we had huge floods a couple of months ago up in Queensland. I mean, they these people just got hammered. I mean, it's normally, they normally have a rainy season, you know, every year, because it's, you know, we're talking, you know, tropical North Queensland. Well, they got hammered. So now, down in Adelaide, there are the floodplains. There are floodplains that haven't seen water for 7 years. And last night, one of the presenters, she's a scientist of some sort. I can't remember if she's a climatologist or a biologist. I can't remember. But she flies out by helicopter and gets to stand actually at the head of the floodplain where the rains from Queensland a couple of months ago were actually coming down and hitting dry, cracked earth for the first time in 7 years. Now, one of the things that they showed last night, that there are certain areas of the river system that have gone so stagnant for so long, the water has pH levels consistent with battery acid. And they reckon that it's something like 10 to 20% of the Australian floodplain has gone acidic. The mud is acidic. pH of like 1.6. And that's the water. So I fear that at the moment, you know, they're going to use opportune timing of just as we have a little bit of a respite by a naturally occurring cycle that used to occur much more regularly than it does now. We're going to see this year a whole bunch of the deniers going, oh, see, it was all bunk. Hey, there's nothing wrong here. Don't look. See, it's been cooler. Yeah, but not really. We have to be looking much more long-term than this. You know, it's kind of like when you have, you know, when you have a relative who suffers, you know, say, you know, Alzheimer's, and they have a really good with it week. You don't say that they're cured, do you? I don't think so. So, you know, World Nut Daily, leave it to them. They're going to come up with this kind of crap and try and drag children into it. Now, I could be called a hypocrite for saying that, you know, if there was a contest for kids to make, you know, global warming films about the real science and offering a cash prize, I probably wouldn't have a problem with that. But see, that's actually sticking to science. That would be like a science prize. So call me a hypocrite, but I do not see kids doing something based on actual fact and science and winning a prize being anywhere near the same thing as trying to indoctrinate children into lies and doubts over something that has such unbelievable significance and importance on their futures. So, there you have it. Now on to more pleasant things. I've been talking for a while about, you know, food. I love food. And I look out my window here at the home studio, and out the back are the wonderful veggie beds that Gail maintains, and I help out by doing what I'm told because I really don't know. And I see the carrots starting to come up, the beetroot starting to come up, all the different salad greens coming up, the spinach is starting to come up. And I've so enjoyed over the last year our reconnecting with real food. And the fact that, you know, we're seeing all this data and the reality of the fact that we're starting to see global food shortages. Grain, rice, cooking oils. And, you know, I've been kind of talking in passing about this for quite a while now, that we really need to reconnect with our sources of food. You know, that it's not some magical factory owned by the supermarket that pumps out from petrochemicals the food you buy. When, if you look at it, that kind of plays out for a lot of it, but that's not how it should be working. And, you know, the Monsantos of the world, well, there really is only one, who are trying to own the building blocks of life, which is food. So, during Peter's show, Lilo in the chat room sent this link to me asking me to check this out. And check out ediblecommunities.com, just like it sounds, E-D-I-B-L-E, communities.com. Now, I've been scanning through this, and I'm very interested. As soon as the show's over, I'm going to sign up. And I'm going to read from their mission statement here. I'm just going to open up the page. And they say, our mission is to transform the way communities shop for, cook, eat, and relate to the food that is grown and produced in their area. We have local, seasonal, authentic foods and culinary traditions. We strive to put a face on every farmer as we tell their stories and champion their efforts towards a more sustainable and safe food system. Through our printed publications, websites, and events, we connect consumers with local growers, retailers, chefs, and food artisans, enabling those relationships to grow and thrive in a mutually beneficial, healthful, and economically viable way. Now, the website seems to have recipes. It's got a blog. And it looks like you can start your own edible community to create a hub for people interested in taking back control of their food sources. And, you know, part of the fight on trying to bring down carbon emissions can be helped in a very real way by utilizing seasonal food. You know, if the blueberries aren't in season, don't have them. Don't pay to have them flown from halfway across the frickin' world so you can have your blueberry pancakes, right? Learn to cook with things that are local. There's less transportation costs. You're not impacting the environment by having to fly all this stuff everywhere when it's really not necessary. In so many ways, we become unbelievably focused and shallow. Spoiled and shallow about our food. We've been spoiled by the concept that we should be able to get anything anytime. And we become shallow in the simple fact that we, as a Western population, feel that we should be able to get anything at any time for the same price all year long. And that's just insane. It's nuts. Now, You know, and I'm seeing that just on their website, there's a scrolling image thing, and it's showing the different local versions of, I guess, either the online magazine or maybe even the there might be a print magazine. And, you know, there's as I'm watching, Edible Hawaiian Islands, and then it switches, Edible Twin Cities, obviously Minnesota. That one I can't read, it's too small. But there's been, like, Edible Vancouver. So the idea is to bring people who want this, who want to get their food locally. And, again, you know, this is one of the, again, one of those things. There's nothing better to me than when I go and spend my hard-earned money, or Gail goes and spends her hard-earned money, when you know that the money you're spending is actually going to some to support someone local, as opposed to going to some massive, you know, internationally owned, probably foreign-owned corporation, paying some minimum wage worker a spit and taking everything off the top. Now, I'm looking in the chat room. Ralph says, you know, it seems that the closest to her is in Chicago. Well, maybe you need to start your own. I'm not sure exactly where you are, Ralph, but, you know, I think the idea is that this is a hub for people to get together on this. You know, that idea of, you know, like-minded people. This is the beauty of the web. Now, they have a section here called Edible Nation. I think this is just fantastic. Well, Edible Nation is the blog. And there's all kind of, there's videos on cooking and talking about nutrition in America, and this is an international site. It's the US, Canada, Europe. I guess I'll kick it and maybe start an Australian one. I was also looking. I was looking at a similar organization that is Australian based, and I'm waiting to get some more information from them on exactly what they're up to, because I think it covers some of this, but it also covers sustainable living in general. And you know, if governments aren't going to get with the program, it's going to be the people that are going to lead by example and get the change that we need to see. Be the change you want to see. You know, going back to Gandhi, you know, be the change you want to see in this world. And I am far from perfect, but Gail and I have tried to do that very thing. We even think that it's had some influence on some of our friends without being preachy, which I know that I can be sometimes. Give me your ear, I'll talk it off. But I like this kind of stuff. I love this kind of stuff where people get together and create the infrastructure. And I'll be curious to check out some of these recipes because, I mean, I love food. How many times on the horn section have we, or in the chat room, gone all food porn? Yeah, I'm talking to you, Lottie. And if you haven't been to the Head On Radio Network forums, go. There is actually a recipe swap in there, which you have to check out, that Lottie set up. And I'm dying to try some of the stuff that he's put out. Talk about, like, just what looks like Italian to die for. And in a very small way, you know, we've already started doing a similar thing, at least with the recipe end. But here, it looks as though they're talking about sourcing, supply, how to cook with local ingredients for localities. I think this is just a brilliant idea. I think it's fantastic. So, I mean, I'm going to sign up. I'm going to check it out. You know, you can have a look and see. You know, here having a look, actually, they have categories by locations, and I'm seeing Edible Austin, Edible Brooklyn, Chesapeake, Edible East End, Iowa River Valley, Portland, Sacramento. Just kind of goes on and on and on and on and on. It's just fantastic. North Carolina. And there's a category called Slow Food Nation, and I kind of, this again is, I think, part of that getting back to connecting to our food sources. You know, we've become such a fast food culture that the idea of actually cooking and having something that takes a little time to prepare is lost. And I think in the fast food culture, do we even taste the food? If it has any taste at all, but do we actually taste it? And when you've actually spent some time preparing something from scratch by hand, the satisfaction and the pleasure that you get out of it is just thrilling to me. As our tomatoes were coming into an end this year, because, you know, we're Southern Hemisphere, the seasons are, you know, 180 degrees flipped from you guys up in the States and whatnot. As our tomatoes came to an end, we had, you know, like 4 kilos or, you know, like almost 8 pounds of green tomatoes. And so what does Gail do? She makes a huge batch of pickled green tomatoes, which are sitting on the shelf, mellowing, and I can't wait until they've had some time to sit and we get to crack that open. And it comes, you know, from our backyard. And I think that this all speaks to the concept of food security. You know, if the economy collapses, the greater economy collapses, it's going to be these local relationships that are going to help people survive. Don't you think? I do. I don't, you know, I see this as being the logical plan to try and make things more local, because if petrol continues, well, not if, as petrol gets to become more and more expensive, getting this stuff to your local grocer is going to become prohibitively expensive. The big, huge industrial farms won't be able to afford to continue farming in the practices that they have been for the last half a century. And the local farmers market is going to be the way that people will survive. You know, on the horn section, you know, we were talking about Schwarzenegger in California, and, you know, when I lived there, I lived up in Chico. And, you know, every weekend, the local farmers market. And it's great. It's great. You go down, and there's everything you could want, from the local bread baker to every supplier of everything that is grown locally, and you buy direct from the grower, and you get, you know, beautiful, beautiful produce, and you get to actually know the people that grow your food if you're not growing it yourself, and that actually builds community. Again, something that I think we've lost so much of over the last couple of decades. You know, the system in which we live in has made us so impersonal. And a great example of that is I actually just met my neighbor last week for the first time. Now, these folks have been living next door for 6 months, maybe. And because of the way that we're just kind of trained and we go around, you know, just thinking about ourselves, walking around in our own little tunnel vision world, And we just never seem to reach out and say hi. And finally, I had an excuse to say hello. And the excuse was my lawnmower had died, grass was 2 foot tall, and I asked if I could borrow their lawnmower. So after that, I go over with a couple of Happy Goblin beers to say thank you, and sat down on their back patio and had a bit of a chat and got to know each other. And suddenly, you know, the world has expanded as far as when I'm on my own property, where I look. I actually now look to that side when I didn't before. Because, you know, and I think, you know, we've gotten into this culture where we expect stuff to just be beamed in from the outside. You know, I watch my telescreen. It tells me what to think. The telescreen told me that eggs are on special down at the Best Buy or whatever. So I'm going to go there and pay for that, and the farmer didn't get squat. Lila mentions the fact that they've got some pick-your-own produce farms near them. That sounds like a great idea, too. You know, it's got to be a good labor saver for the farmer. You know, cordon off an area where people can go and pick their own. I think that's a fantastic idea. And that's much more community. It's so much more community-oriented. And I can only think that we'll be better people if we think more about our local communities, you know. I sometimes think that this has all gotten so big and so sprawled out and so impersonal. It can get to be a little bit depressing. And I think that, you know, start making the local connections now so you have them in place, because, you know, if the whole thing goes balls up, you're going to be forced to do it, and you're going to be way behind where you need to be, and you're going to be in trouble. I love it. I dig it. I totally dig it. And, you know, I reckon we're only a couple weeks away before some of our own produce is ready to be picked from the winter veggies. The greens are coming up really nice. I'm really looking forward to, and I've got this in my head, of a pasta made with our own homegrown spinach. Why, that just completely has me just drooling. But, yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to. And I'll tell you, you know, when the tomatoes started coming in this past summer, and got to pick the first couple of them, and I cut into one, and I was just like, wow. My brain just remembered what a tomato tastes like. You know? And one of the most common things here in Australia, you know, when you do the, you know, egg and bacon breakfast is you cut up some tomatoes and stick them out of the grilled tomatoes. And very often you'll find people in this country will, you know, put a little bit of, you know, aside from the salt and pepper and the olive oil, might put a little sugar on there. And when we first cut into these, the sugar content in them was so high because they were grown properly that they were unbelievably sweet. They were gorgeous. Some of the best pasta sauce we've made has come out of that. And, you know, thanks to folks like Bob Kincaid and Nanette in the chat room, are, you know, and this is, you know, here I've got my local community, but my local community stretches to West Virginia, are helping to teach me about the techniques of canning and, you know, soon it'll be preserves and things like that. And I just, you know, the basics can be so pleasurable, you know, and yeah, it takes a little bit of work, but boy, do we carry a whole lot less stuff back from the big industrial grocery market, you know. There's less stuff to carry back because we've got a source right here in our backyard, and we're in the middle of the city. Groovy stuff. It's groovy stuff. So we're coming up on, oh, we got a few minutes left here, but, check it out. Edible, edible communities.com. And this Australian one, I'm checking into a little bit more, finding out a little bit more about them, because they also ask for when you sign up with them, this Australian sustainable communities outfit, about either your center of study or what you do in the way of activism when it comes to sustainable living. So I'm hoping that, you know, telling them that, you know, I do this little internet radio show and whatnot, that maybe we can get one of the folks on the air to talk about sustainable living. Because, I mean, that's a huge subject when you think about it, you know. It's two words, but, I mean, what falls under those two words is just huge. You know, sustainable living when it comes to, you know, the way you use water, the way you generate and utilize power, the way you build your home, what you build your home out of. You know, I mean, it's one of those things that just kind of goes on and 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 on. And another thing that both this Edible Communities and some other outfits talk about is the concept, and I'm picking this up from the chat room, is about saving seeds. See, this is where the Monsanto factor comes in. You know, they want to own the rights to the building blocks of life. So there's a little bit of a battle going on that we need to save the seed that hasn't been infected by Monsanto to make sure that it continues on. You know, heirloom varieties of fruits and vegetables. You know, I think all the seed that we get from Eden Seeds and one other outfit that Gail supplies from, it's all, you know, organic, no GM nonsense, heirloom varieties. You know, the wonderful apple cucumbers that we had all summer long, they were just gorgeous. And again, this is another thing, more local information. You know, as water becomes harder and harder to get and more scarce, one of the best things you can do is, and you can find these things fairly easily, is to grow varieties that are drought tolerant, that survive harsh summers. Because, you know, as things progress, one of the hardest things we're going to be dealing with is getting used to using less and less water. This country has done pretty bloody well over the last few years out of necessity to use less and less water. Hence why the issue of global warming has really, you know, kind of gotten some real traction, because in this vast nation of a mere 22 million people, no one was protected and unaffected by the 7 years of drought. Now, I tell you that we've had a wet winter. Well, it's been wet here where it's been extremely dry, but while it's been wet here on the eastern seaboard, down in South Australia, they've been dry as a bone, hot as hell. So these are not consistent changes globe-wide because, hey, the atmosphere is this whole bunch of potential. And potential and energy tries to equalize itself. It's just kind of how it works. And in that process, you end up with disturbance. So the more energy we keep firing up into the system, the more disturbance there's going to be as it continues to try and equalize itself. And I was also mentioned in the chat room that there's the the Australian Seed Savers Network, which is exactly what it says, you know, saving seeds, making sure that these things are able to, you know, continue. And it's a groovy thing. So anyway, we're out of here, folks, for the week. Thanks to Bob Kincaid for producing. Thanks to Scott Barry at B1 Ladder Productions for the music. Thank you to Billy Shears for the segment today on Jack Johnson. Thanks to Ben Burt at the White Rose Society for all the streaming and all the archives. And as we say here on Foxed Up, be good, be green. We'll see you on Monday.
And the sign said, long-haired, freaky people need not apply. So I stuck my hair up under my hat, and I went in to ask him why.